This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Yesterday, a 16-year-old was stabbed just outside Bulkley High School in Hartford. He's being treated for his injury. Police are investigating, but have called it an isolated incident. On April 25th, 16-year-old Maren Sanchez was attacked and killed at Jonathan Law High School in Milford. The student accused of the attack is 16-year-old Christopher Plaskin. He's being charged as an adult. This week, students at Franklin Regional High School in Murrysville, Pennsylvania, my old high school, were handed out clear backpacks. It's another security measure for a school still recovering from a mass stabbing of 20 students by a single attacker in early April. In Connecticut especially, these stories leave raw feelings after the tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary in 2012. But that mass shooting took us down the path of discussing guns in schools and hardened school buildings to prevent something like that from happening again, no matter how random that attack, no matter how rare. This new series of attacks hits us a bit differently. Knives aren't guns, and there's no easy place to put the blame for these attacks. Most importantly, even after all the post-Newtown changes, it leaves many parents and students feeling schools are less safe than ever. But is that really true? Are kids safe at school? It's what we'll be talking about on our program today. We want you to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Once again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can always email your questions and thoughts to wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive. We'll be looking at some efforts to make schools safer and also to make schools feel safer. But first, an update on the 16-year-old Hartford student who's now in stable condition at Connecticut Children's Medical Center after being stabbed outside Bulkley High School just yesterday. Brian Foley joins us once again in the program. He's deputy chief of the Hartford Police Department. Good to see you once again. Thanks for coming in, sir.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
Maybe you can just give us an update. What do we know about what happened yesterday?
There was about 3:30. The kids were letting out of school, getting on the school buses. Some kids from another school had come over. There was an argument. One student, we believe, spit on another. There was a fight. Unfortunately, as you tragically heard, one of the students was stabbed with what was described as a kitchen knife on scene by witnesses. He was taken to Hartford Hospital. He was in serious condition, but we now expect him to fully recover from his wounds.
And as far as the attacker or attackers, what do we know about them, and do we have people in custody now?
Well, we did. We had two in custody based on what witnesses told us at the scene. But we're still we ended up releasing everyone last night. You don't want to lock up the wrong kid in this incident. So we're following up hard this morning. The guys are out there as we speak. There should be a lot of video. The Hartford school system does a good job blanketing the schools with video. Our buses have videos, and these were all around the buses. So our detectives are there now pulling that video, and we should have some pretty concrete answers within a day or two.
When you called it an isolated incident, what exactly does that mean?
There might be some apathy towards violence in Hartford here, but in our school system, the school security and the public schools in Hartford do a great job with keeping the schools safe and not having violent incidents within the school, considering we are in the city here. So that's why it was isolated. When I say isolated also, we don't anticipate there wasn't anything before this. And we don't anticipate anything after this. This was a matter of two kids basically getting in a schoolyard fight, literally. It wasn't inside the school. It was outside. And unfortunately, one of the kids had a knife.
When we talk about school safety, especially in urban areas, there is always the sense that the school extends in a different way than it does in other communities, meaning that often incidents will happen outside of school, not necessarily inside of school because of the increased security, but they are in some ways school-related. Can you talk a little bit about that and how your police department handles dealing with things having to do with violence or threats of violence inside or outside of a school building?
Well, I mean, you got to look at urban areas have been handling violence or at least school security for a lot longer than schools in the suburbs. And you've been having cops in schools now for 20 years. In Hartford, we're removing our students' exposure to the police department. We're backing our officers out of the schools and trying to break that chain of from students going from the school system into our prison system. Our arrests in Hartford of juveniles are down, I think, 50% to 60%, trying to make sure they don't have a criminal history when they get out of our high schools to reduce that number significantly. In that, the school security system in Hartford has increased their responsibility, and their director's fantastic. Works with the police department every single day. He was there yesterday. We talked to him overnight. So they upgraded their responsibilities, so we were able to back out and not affect the school system and limit the students' exposures to negative police contact.
One of the things that we've talked about and we've covered on our program and on our air before is the question of whether or not there's gang activity in and around the schools in Hartford or in the other cities. It doesn't always mean the traditional gangs like the ones we saw in the early 1990s that were multinational really in scope and dealing drugs not just in Hartford and all over the place, but smaller groups of kids who identify in gangs. I'm wondering if that had any role in yesterday's attack or what we know about gang activity in and around the schools in Hartford.
Well, any fight you're going to have in a school, I mean, just think about when you went to high school, you probably called them cliques. Groups essentially aren't going to get along, and that's going to when there is a fight, generally those two cliques or groups are going to clash, and I'd say that's consistent with what happened yesterday. Two cliques seem to be two separate different groups essentially clashed. There was a fight, and again, one kid had a knife.
We're talking today on the program about school safety, not just school safety as we know it in numbers, but also the perceptions of school safety after a series of stabbings over the course of the last couple of weeks, and of course shootings at schools around the country. Many parents are left wondering, are our schools safe places to be? In just a moment, we're going to talk with somebody who has a bit more in terms of statistics on that. But I want to bring into the conversation William Shea, who's Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection, into our conversation. Commissioner, thanks for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity to spend some time with you today.
I also want to welcome in Don DeFranzo, who's Commissioner of the Department of Administrative Services, who works on this on these issues as well. Thank you, sir, for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Before we take a look at the national scope and talk about some of the other instances that are happening, I'm wondering first, William Shea, if you can talk a little bit about this perception versus reality question. Many people feel that in urban areas, schools may be unsafe places, but as Deputy Chief Foley said, sometimes these schools have very, very tight security because they've been dealing with this for a very long time. Suburban schools, rural schools, this is something that we haven't thought about until Newtown and then recent incidents. I mean, do you have a sense that schools are safer than ever, less safe than ever? I mean, give us a perception versus reality check here.
Sure. First of all, one of the most precious things that we have is when you drop your child off for school at the beginning of the day, you expect to be able to pick that child up, or whether it be on a bus or parent pickup, safe and kept safe throughout the day. I think that we have safe schools, and that everything that we are collectively doing as a state and at the municipal level is to continue to improve that. Every community is a little bit different. They all have different challenges, different potential threats, and each school is built around how to address those threats. And each one has its own set of parameters in order to protect their students. So each one's a little bit different, but I do think that they are safe and they're continuing to get safe. And we've put things in place to enhance that.
I like your thoughts on this. I mean, when we talk about school safety, we've put a lot of different procedures in place. Mm. Some schools have gone to armed security guards that have never had them in the past. We certainly spent a lot of money on trying to improve whether it's windows that are bulletproof or doors that lock more securely. Do you think that in the course of the last few years since the Newtown attack, Commissioner, we've gotten safer in our schools?
Well, first let me say I agree with Commissioner Shea. I think, I think the statistically schools are safe places. When the legislature put in place this study committee in 2013, I think implicit in that legislation was the sense that schools are seen as vulnerable facilities, vulnerable to the threats. And in the time since, there has been a marked increase in attention paid to school security in our state. We have approximately 1,300 public schools, marked increase in focus on security, whether it's structural security, which I was most directly involved in, or the operational plans, which Commissioner Shea was directly involved in. So a great deal has been done in both fronts in the last year and a half.
We're going to take some of your phone calls in a moment at 860-275-7266. But I want to bring in Dr. Stephen Brock, who's a professor of school psychology at California State University, Sacramento. He's president-elect of the National Association of School Psychologists. He got up early in California to join us today. And Dr. Brock, thank you so much for being here on Where We Live.
My pleasure, John.
I guess I'd like to ask you that broad question first. Here in Connecticut, because of the series of incidents we've had over the course of the last couple of years, a lot of parents and students are worried, and we worry about school safety. I'll just say parenthetically, yesterday Schools out in my part of the state were locked down for a time being because there was a shooting at a residence in Oxford. The perpetrator or the accused perpetrator was on the run, and he went to my hometown of Winsted, Connecticut, and all the schools got locked down once again for a time period. There's this feeling, Dr. Brock, that schools have these incidents all the time, that we're locking down, that we're unsafe, that we should be worried. Should we be worried about our kids?
Well, let me begin by answering your question with the statement that one child being hurt or harmed or most tragically killed at school is one too many. And so I'm very, very appreciative of the attention and the energy that we're giving this topic. We need to do all we can to make sure that schools are a safe place and that parents can, in fact, trust that when they drop their kids off at school, they're going to be safe and they're going to pick them up at the end of the day and everything's going to be fine. However, the reality is that schools are safe and arguably safer today than they were 10, 15 years ago. In fact, I'm prepared to argue that at least when it comes to a violent death, the one place I want my child to be is at school. Because if you look at the national statistics, that's the place where violent death is, in fact, least likely to occur.
How much of that is due to the fact that we have changed so many policies and we've taken school security so much more seriously since the attacks in Columbine in Colorado some years ago?
Yeah, we've been tracking these national trends since the early 90s. And I think it's safe to say that a percentage of the decline can be attributed to physical security measures. Schools today are much more aware of principles such as crime prevention through environmental design, where they essentially strive to make the physical structure of the school a safer place. However, I think if we focus entirely on these physical safety measures, we miss the point, which is that safety at school is both physical and psychological. And so I would also attribute the decline to not just physical safety measures, but also to greater attention and awareness to issues like school climate, to issues like connectedness to adults at school. I think a substantial percentage of the decline can be attributed to kids being more connected to adults at school and consequently better able to talk to them, share with them issues of concern, and in many cases prevent acts of violence from occurring on school grounds.
We're going to be talking about some of the differences between school security when it comes to just hardening the exterior of schools and hiring school security guards and what it might mean to put more adults who are able to interface with kids in schools in just a few moments. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. I want to go to Bob, who's calling from Newington quickly. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I wonder how much of the perception of school violence is caused by the 24-hour news cycle that we're in. Because if you look at the statistics, school violence has been dropping, and even in the year when Columbine happened, I think school violence was down like 5% from the year before. And I just wonder if, you know, right now we're here in Connecticut, but, you know, if a kid gets cut from a basketball team in Washington State and starts a fight with his gym teacher, we hear about it here, and it's a two-hour news story if nothing else is happening in the world.
Bob, I think you raise a question that I know Dr. Brock has looked quite a bit at, and I'm wondering if you could comment on Bob's comment there.
Yeah, Bob's right. I agree with Bob. I think perceptions are to a large extent shaped by a new era in media coverage. It was really post-Columbine that I kind of woke up and realized things were different. CNN was in full bore then, and for some reason I was up at 3 a.m. in the morning, happened to click on the TV and saw a group of students at Columbine School talking to a reporter. And it was then that I realized that, wow, we can literally hear about a story like this 24/7. And of course, since Columbine, we've introduced the element of competition into this media coverage. So now we have Fox News competing with CNN and MSNBC for our viewing. And I think what happens is these events get to a significant extent sensationalized, and we oftentimes lose sight of what reality is, which is, yes, one is one too many, and it's horrible, and it's tragic, and we must do more to make our schools safer. But the reality is that they're safer today than they were.
And, but before we take a break and before I let you go, Brian Foley, and it was good of you to come in and give us an update on what happened in Hartford yesterday, this is a conversation I think you and I have had in the past on this program, which is the sensationalism that comes around a school stabbing or a school shooting often is focused on an individual incident. It's sometimes focused on the fact that it happens in a quote-unquote safe suburban high school. You deal on a regular basis in Hartford, a place where stabbings and shootings and other acts of violence are much more common. And I guess I wonder, from your perception, as you listen to Dr. Brock and our callers talk about that, how it feels to be involved in policing a community where we frankly don't have 24/7 news coverage of a stabbing of a kid outside of high school, right? We don't. We're not going to be talking about that on CNN at all.
The bottom line is if this incident yesterday occurred 2 weeks ago, it wouldn't be a blip on the radar screen. The sensationalism of Sandy Hook, especially in this state, and understand it's a very tragic incident, but you had a minor, small graffiti thing happen on a playground, and that was headline news throughout the country that this memorial had some graffiti on it. It was positive graffiti, essentially, saying peace to the people. And that was taking precedence. So this stuff sells in media. Period. The stuff sells to the news markets, and yesterday was a feeding frenzy of media at the school. So it's just what we have to deal with. It doesn't change the fact that these incidents are occurring. Now we're just more aware of them. Not necessarily a bad thing, but it can present problems.
But it's also true that it is unlikely that any of these networks, these 24-hour news networks, even if the outcome yesterday in Hartford was much worse, and the young man who was stabbed would have perished, like Marin Sanchez, that we would have as much attention on a stabbing outside a city high school
as
we would outside or inside a suburban high school. It's just the truth.
Correct. And it's like the heroin problem. You know, you've had it in the cities forever. Once it hit the suburbs, now it's a big deal. And we've been dealing with it in Hartford here. We have a bit of, an advanced approach, but now it's in the suburbs. The violence is in the school in the suburbs. Now it's a huge deal, and it is.
Brian Foley is Deputy Chief of the Hartford Police Department. Thanks so much for stopping by. I appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we're going to take some more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. We're also going to be talking more with Dr. Stephen Brock about the perception and realities of school violence. And we want to continue our conversation with two commissioners here who are working on making our schools safer, William Shea and Donald DeFranzo. Again, you can join us 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live.
Do you think schools offer safe environments for kids?
It's kind of dependent on the school district itself and what kind of regulations they set.
I do. I do believe that they offer safe environments for children. There's a heightened sense of awareness about it, and I think everybody's involved in protecting the children, from administrators to the teachers to everybody who works there.
I think schools are doing the best they can.
No.
Not at all.
There's lots of fights at our school.
Yeah.
The voices you heard were gathered by our intern, Anna Novak, who took the streets of West Hartford to ask people about the safety of our schools. This is what we're talking about here on Where We Live today. I'm John Dankowski. We are joined in studio by William Shea, who's Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection, and also by Donald DeFranzo, who's Commissioner of the Department of Administrative Services. We're going to be talking throughout the course of our conversation with Dr. Stephen Brock, who's a professor of school psychology at California State University, Sacramento. We want to take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 because people want to join this conversation. Steve's in Franklin. Hi, Steve.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Listen, just briefly, I do want to congratulate you for having this show and looking at school security versus just focusing on guns. The national media hasn't even hardly mentioned these incidents recently in Connecticut, which were carried out with something other than guns. So it's good to see the discussion focusing on the area that it should be focused on. And I agree with the recent caller talking about the 24-hour news cycle. I think the young man who was caught recently preparing to do something at his school said that his heroes were the boys at Columbine. So the more it's glamorized and the more it's covered, the more you'll have people seeing this. So I just wanted to congratulate you for having this show focusing on the right issues. Thank you.
Steve, thank you very much. I'll just ask our two commissioners here, and Donald DeFranza, maybe you can chime in first. We have had a conversation over the course of the last couple of years that centered an awful lot on guns. And look, it's the way we do things, not just in Connecticut, but everywhere. When something happens, we want to keep that thing from happening again. Mm-hmm. But as I said in the introduction, that thing that happened at Sandy Hook was so rare and so random. It was unlike anything, as I knock wood, that has ever happened in this state or in this world again. Have we spent too much time focusing on solving that problem when there's so many other issues to get at when it comes to school security?
Well, I think that's a great observation, and the caller is right on, I think. When we undertook our study of the structural issues around schools, it was motivated primarily by that incident in Newtown. But our discussion quickly turned to the wide variety of threats that are posed to the school population, ranging from the weather, seismic events, environmental hazards, terrorism. So we've taken, and this has been uniform across state policy since then, what we call an all-hazards approach to school violence. And so we're looking at things, as I indicated, that list I just mentioned, but also the behavioral aspects of students in schools and what they bring in from their neighborhoods and bring in from their outer communities. And so there is a comprehensive approach being taken. As a public policy matter, up until now the state has, although we're the primary funder of school construction, we have not instituted any uniform standards for school safety. And part of what we have done is now put in place a set of standards which all municipalities using state funding will have to adhere to in the future.
But when we talk about state funding, and Commissioner Shea, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about this, how much have we spent on solving the problems of hardened school security and making sure we have safer physical buildings versus how much money have we spent on school counselors and trying to deal with some of the environmental issues that Commissioner DeFranza was just talking about?
I can't necessarily give you the numbers for the other environmental side, but I can give you specifically what we've done over the past year with regards to hardening of schools. Under the leadership of the legislature and Governor Malloy, we instituted a school security and safety competitive grant. And the intent with this grant was to be able to harden schools, make them more safe. Initially, it was bonded for $15 million. We got or received $21 million in requests. And this is a grant that the Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection jointly administers with the Department of Education. We ended up receiving requests from 111 different school districts and 604 schools total. And Governor Malloy and the team were able to find additional funding to actually fund the full $21 million, and that's a reimbursement grant. And it's designed to do things such as make windows more safe, hardening of doors, lock systems, video capability, video recording capability to make the schools more safe. And that money is rolling out to the communities on a reimbursable basis at this time.
And obviously we're spending that money in part because it's being made available. It's something that's a nationwide effort, not just a Connecticut effort. But I mean, do we have any sense of the ways in which we've invested in these other things, the other ways in which students can be safer, Commissioner DeFranza?
Well, I think, you know, we have a very decentralized education system in Connecticut.
Yes, we do.
And I was just indicating one of our great challenges on the physical structure side of things is to develop standards which also allow municipalities the flexibility to develop the kinds of schools that they see are appropriate for their community. So many of the issues you're addressing are local decisions. How many school security guards, how many resource officers, how many school counselors are being added. My sense is, although I don't have hard numbers, my sense is that the debate around mental health services has sparked a new interest and new resources in that area. It is a comprehensive challenge we're facing. It's not just buildings. It's not just security standards, but it is the mental health issues and the behavioral issues that come into play as well.
Looking from a national perspective, Dr. Brock, in California, I'm wondering if you feel like we as a nation have the balance right. We have spent a lot of money, federal, state, local money, to try to harden doors and lock things up. But do you think that we're spending the sort of money that we need to on some of these other services?
The short answer would be no. I do am a strong proponent of these physical security and safety measures. However, I think that they only go so far. I mean, you can get to the point where you start to treat schools as if they're prisons and students as if they're prisoners. I mean, you could take it to that extreme. And, of course, we all know how safe prisons are. They're not. And consequently, I think there needs to be more than just lip service paid to the issue of some of these psychological safety matters, which involve making sure that we have more school-based mental health professionals available to help students and address some of the issues, the challenges, the problems that lead to school violence.
And I will say that we reached out to the Connecticut Department of Education to see if they wanted to have somebody available for this conversation. They were unable to do that, but if you have thoughts from your school district about this issue, 860-275-7266. Let's go to Kevin, who's calling from Windsor. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing okay. What's on your mind?
Well, I always thought that the focus on incidents like Sandy Hook are really misdirected because that happened once. And every day in every school, there's kids being bullied. There's kids having fights. There's cliques in every school. So if we want to focus on school safety, we should think about the things that happen everywhere.
Kevin, I really appreciate what you had to say, and it helps lead us into our next guest here, Dr. Amanda Nickerson, who's director of the Alberti Center for Bullying Abuse Prevention and associate professor of counseling at the University of Buffalo, SUNY's Graduate School of Education. Dr. Nickerson, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You heard what Kevin just said. He makes the case that I think a lot of us are making, that we do focus on these extreme events, whether they're shootings or stabbings, the things that don't happen all that often but grab the headlines. He says there's bullying going on every single day in school, and that's school violence, and that we don't pay enough attention to that. Do you agree?
I do agree. I think that the high-profile events, Columbine, Sandy Hook, and others, have definitely caused us to pay a lot of attention to these issues. But I do think that our attention to those issues has brought up our focus on bullying and some of the other issues that are happening, as Kevin says, on a daily basis. And many that are devoted to this issue are arguing that we do need a very comprehensive approach that looks at all levels of violence, because some of these are precursors to these larger events, but more importantly, many of them aren't, but they are in and of themselves important and a threat to the safety of our students.
As an expert on bullying in schools, something we've talked about on our program a lot, I'm wondering if you can give us a sense about how bullying, the type of bullying that we maybe grew up with ourselves, and also cyberbullying and some of the things that are brand new to schools, how that can or cannot directly be linked to violent acts, whether it's fights in school or more extreme events like this?
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that they are very related, that individuals that bully others are also at higher risk for engaging in a variety of other violent behaviors, physical fights, dating violence, things like that. We have more and more long-term studies that are showing that individuals who bully others are at higher risk for criminal convictions, substance abuse, and other problems in later life. So there's definitely a relationship. However, we don't want to oversimplify it either. There are certainly individuals that bully others that don't go on to have these more serious, severe, and ongoing problems, but there's definitely a link.
I think one of the things that has happened since since Columbine, there is this narrative, which turned out not to be the correct narrative, about bullying and that as a cause for what happened there. In the most recent stabbing incident in Pennsylvania, immediately people asked questions about whether or not this was a student who was bullied. And I'll be frank with you, Dr. Nickerson, because it was my high school and because I am of an age that many of my former classmates have kids in that school, a lot of the conversation amongst parents was about bullying and its impacts on people. And I'm wondering if we make too much of this, if we too quickly look for the blame in an extreme incident and we say, well, someone is bullied, we need to change the culture around that. Or can we say this is truly an isolated incident and it has more to do with frankly, mental health services than anything else?
Yeah, so you're talking about the idea that someone who's bullied or bullied chronically is then going to act out in a violent way.
It's something that many people jump to, right? Especially
right.
Since Columbine, they're looking for an easy cause for why it happened. Like when Maren Sanchez was killed, we immediately looked at the cause. Was it some sort of a jilted boyfriend, as opposed to looking a bit more deeply at the situation?
Right. I do think that now we are looking, and maybe always we've wanted to do this, we're looking for what is the cause. But we all know there isn't one cause. It could be a contributor. This happens a lot now in suicides, is that I'm hearing more and more that people, the next question after someone finds out that a youth has committed suicide is, were they bullied? Because we're making that link in our mind. And I would be remiss to say that there isn't a relationship at all. I mean, when the U.S. Secret Service did their analysis of the school shootings, they did find that 2/3 of the perpetrators were either known victims or they perceived themselves to be victims of ongoing bullying. However, if you look at the prevalence of people that are bullied, the likelihood that someone is going to act out in a violent way is extremely slim, and there's always other factors that are going on as well. So it's really a problem when we're oversimplifying things. People are using the term bully side, you know, someone's bullied to commit suicide, and I think that's a really, really dangerous kind of thing to be throwing around, because it makes it sound like suicide is something as that there's a one-to-one correspondence, and we know that that's not the case.
I'm wondering, Dr. Stephen Brock, if you have any thoughts on what Dr. Nickerson just had to say, maybe to expand on her conversation.
No, not other than to say that I think that she's right on. Her comments are very to the point. I guess the only thing I would add is that I think that there's a constant search for the profile of the school shooter. Mm-hmm. And that there's some magical way we can, in advance, figure out who it is that's going to perpetrate some act of school violence. And, yeah, while many of them do have bullying in common, there is, in fact, no reliable profile of a school shooter.
We're talking about the perceptions and realities of school safety in Connecticut and in America today. Our guests by phone are Dr. Stephen Brock, who is from California State University of Sacramento. Dr. Amanda Nickerson also joins us. She's from the Alberti Center for Bullying Abuse Prevention. She's also from SUNY in Buffalo. Joining us in studio, two commissioners, Donald DeFronzo, the Department of Administrative Services, and William Shea from the Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection. We've got a lot of people who want to join us on the phone, so let's go to Danny in Springfield. Hi, Danny. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? I'd just like to say, first of all, I do have a lot of experience regarding school violence and responding to, you know, school threats, active shooter, et cetera. A lot of the guests that you have on, they're right on the money. They're talking about comprehensive approaches to it, because, of course, there are. You know, you can look at the mental health aspect, and these are all the possible precursors to something happening to a school, no doubt. But the question comes down to, are our schools safer than they were several years ago? The answer is yes, because obviously all the focus is starting to, especially from, you know, Columbine High School to Newtown, et cetera. We need to make our schools safer, and there's a couple ways to do that. But we don't neglect or say, like one of your callers said, hey, we're going to, you know, there's bullying that goes on and things like this. It almost dismisses the fact that because of the infrequency of school shootings and things like that, that we kind of put that on the back burner, which it makes no sense. You could compare it to 9/11. 9/11, all of the airplanes in our country had unsecured cockpits, right? A passenger could get right into where the cockpits were. After 9/11, they became hard targets after that, right? Now, nobody can get in there. Planes are safer. People are safer on the planes.
That's right.
Even though it was a very infrequent thing. But we still take that. Now that it happened, of course we're going to take the measures now to prevent it from happening in the future.
Well, Danny, you raise a really good point that I'd like to put to Commissioner Shea here and maybe pair that with a tweet that we got from Rachel. She says, I visited approximately 10 local high schools and been impressed by security, but many schools trusted my looks as a professional person and did not require me to show ID or sign in. We want to trust people. So both Rachel and Danny are getting at different points of the same thing. Something that changed after 9/11 is, well, we're taking off our shoes and we've got locked cockpits. And we just accepted that as point of fact. Before the shootings at Sandy Hook, I was hearing about schools as places that should be open to the whole community, that should be community centers. People can come and go as they please. And now we're starting to think of them more as places where you have to be buzzed in and you have to be a trusted person. And if you look the wrong way, you might not be let in. I guess I'm just wondering if you can comment on this, how far we've gone toward adopting brand new norms of safety around schools, and if you think we need to go further.
Sure. Let me comment on a couple things there. First of all, we have the safest aviation programs in the world. Yet anytime there is an aviation mishap, we investigate that significantly, and we constantly improve those programs. We're constantly improving the safety. Same thing on the school security side. Anytime there's an incident that occurs, as unfortunate as they are, those get added to the toolkit to continue to improve the safety at our schools. First piece. Second thing, answering that, one of the things that we've done here in Connecticut as part of Public Act 13-3 last year was to establish school security and safety plan standards so that there's a standard requirement, if you will, for every school, public school, in developing their standards. And there's basically 12 standards that go through it, and some are small, but some are significant. And it includes things such as involvement of multiple local officials, organization of command structures if there is an incident under the National Incident Management System, establishment of a school security and safety committee within the school, ensure that the Board of Education reviews the safety and security plan from the schools, tie into the local emergency operations plan, procedures for managing different types of emergencies and crises, evaluation and feedback on fire drills and crisis response drills, and a few other areas that go along with it. So we have instituted that here in Connecticut with the intent that the standards are there. We've also provided a template so that schools don't have to develop that from scratch. Basically about 140-page template for developing their plan. And it also allows a little bit of plug and play so there's at least a little bit of commonality among different school systems and schools.
Amanda Nickerson, I know we just have a few minutes left with you, and I'd like to ask you about something that gets back to our original point about perception versus reality and making schools not only safer but also feel like safer places. I mentioned before you were on the show that just yesterday, aside from the stabbing that we had outside of Hartford High School, we had a situation in which several rural school districts were shut down for a time period, locked down, because there was an armed man on the loose, someone who had been involved in a shooting several towns away. That sort of incident seems to be happening more often. Because of this hypervigilance, we now more readily lock things down. We have a bit more security at the doors. What do you think the long-term impact on learning, Dr. Nickerson, is when we live in a world where, for better or for worse, we just seem to be a little bit more guarded, a little bit more fearful, a little bit more watchful on a daily basis, more ready to lock things down to keep kids safe? Do you think it has a long-term impact on the way kids actually learn?
That's, as a researcher, I would say that's a really interesting research question. I don't know. I think that we definitely are more aware and alert and are taking these precautions. And as the commissioner just said, there's many different comprehensive approaches that are being taken. And so putting kids in lockdown is really supposed to make them more safe and make sure that they can get back to the learning environment as quickly as possible. But of course, on the flip side, I think what we're talking about with this, you know, you want your schools, your community schools, to be open learning environments where people can come in and visit and not have to feel like they're going to be frisked. But I think it is just a reality that we need both, that we need to find the balance between those physical safety precautions and bolstering the kind of climate that we're creating in the school. And it is possible. Our colleague Dewey Cornell from Virginia has done quite a bit of research in this area, looking at, is it schools that have high security that are safe, or is it schools that have high support? And not surprisingly, it's schools that have both high security and high support that are safest in terms of perceptions and then actual behavior. So I don't think it's an either-or question. We do just have to be careful that our students are not, you know, being startled into thinking that they live in a really unsafe world and that they're not going to be able to focus on their academics because they're so worried about what's happening.
You raise something that I want to just quickly put to Don DeFranzo here. It's not an either-or question, but as someone who's served in state government at the state level, the municipal level, look, the money's got to come from somewhere, and we're investing money in certain things. We're maybe not investing as much money in other things. And to the doctor's point, we need to have high security in some cases and a lot of supports. Where do we get the money? How do we make the case that this is actually what we need? Both things, not just one.
Yeah. Well, this is where public policy decisions, you know, where legislators and governors get paid their salaries to make these tough decisions. Where do we allocate our resources? In Connecticut, I think we've aligned this as one of our high priorities. The governor has certainly allocated, as Commissioner Shea said, tens of millions of dollars for immediate responses in schools. We are building in these standards into our normal school construction program, which we really spend about $600 million a year on, roughly. So major dollars. We anticipate that these improvements that we're putting into standards will probably cost us in new construction probably 5 to 10% more annually because of the elevated standards. And we're asking for redundant communication systems, standardized systems across the board in many areas. And then the mental health investments and behavioral adjustments, school security guards, many of those will come from other state agencies or from localities themselves, which I think are identifying school security also as a high priority.
But when we mandate certain building specifications, and we maybe put some money aside for that, but then we don't mandate the other things. We say it's up to municipalities to do the mental health and the counseling and all that stuff, and you can fund it at the local level with your own property tax base, but we're going to mandate that you got to build schools a certain way. Doesn't that send a different, maybe the wrong message?
Well, I think some of these things are a little more complicated. I mean, we're
I'm sure.
The state is the primary funder of school buildings, so I think it's a little easier for us to get at that issue and be more direct about it. The issues of the other types of resources, I think the jury's still out. Recommendations are still forthcoming on some of the mental health issues. That's been a very complicated debate in the legislature. But I don't think we've heard the end of that, and I don't think we've heard the end of the kind of resources that the state's prepared to dedicate to that once we come to a consensus on what it is we want to do.
When we come back from our break, we're going to get some more of your phone calls. A lot of people want to join our conversation about school violence, whether or not we actually have safer schools or we just feel like our schools are unsafe because of all the coverage that we've seen recently. I want to thank Dr. Amanda Nickerson, who joined us. She's director of the Alberti Center for Bullying Abuse Prevention, and she's also an associate professor at the University of Buffalo, SUNY's Graduate School of Education. We'll continue our conversation where we live right after this break. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to listen to some big music from a very big band. West End Blend is a 14-piece group that incorporates jazz and Afrobeat and hip-hop, performing really spectacular covers and original songs. We did a special studio session with them at Telefunken in South Windsor. We're going to be hearing from this group of young, very vibrant musicians tomorrow, and I really, really can't wait to present them on Where We Live tomorrow. So I hope you can join us. Today, we're talking about violence in our schools, perception and reality, with Dr. Stephen Brock from California State University, Sacramento, and also Donald DeFronzo, Commissioner of the Department of Administrative Services, and William Shea, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection. Let's go to the phones. A lot of people want to join us in the last few minutes. Paul's in Colchester. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to mention a couple things. First off, my daughter is actually in preschool, and we picked her school because of the security checkpoints and so forth that you have to go through, which made us feel quite secure. But after about 6 months of those checkpoints, the reality is it's just also security because almost anybody can get through them. But my daughter does feel very secure, and that's really what matters in the end. The first part I want to mention was I actually went to Cheney Tech, and we actually had a gun club at our school, and the kids brought their guns on the school bus to the school, and then from there I went to a rifle range afterwards and did skeet shooting. And I just thought that was kind of interesting on, you know, from where we came, and that was back in the 80s, to where we are now. But the bigger issue that I see that's really kind of me is never addressed that goes along with all of this. Is where we've kind of come, and it'll be a controversial thing, and I'm sure I'll upset a few people, but it's where we've come as far as parents are concerned and what we're teaching our kids, that we don't give them coping skills that they need, that when they're confronted with something that frustrates them, it immediately becomes a fight rather than it may be a flight kind of situation, and they don't have coping skills to reason, you know, whether this is something worth getting upset about or just shrug it off.
Well, Paul, you raise such a really important point, and I want to quickly, before we get to another caller here, put that to Dr. Stephen Brock, that idea of coping skills, about dealing with incidents, whether or not it's a rejection or just a scuffle. We've heard about this in the cities for years, Doctor, that often things that we might have settled with words or fists are often settled with guns inside or outside of school. I'm wondering how much stock you put in what Paul from Colchester just had to say about parental involvement and teaching kids coping skills.
I think Paul's absolutely right. The development of skills, and particularly coping skills, is a critical prevention strategy that addresses all sorts of problems, including the problem of school violence. That would be a piece to the puzzle of what I referred to earlier as psychological safety. Mm. I would also agree that parents have a primary role in all of this. And with my graduate students, one of the first things that we talk about in this regard is what we can do to empower, enable, and support the role of parents as they help their kids cope with life challenges.
Dr. Stephen Brock, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
I want to go to Chris from Hartford quickly. Chris, go ahead. We just have about a minute or so.
Good morning, John. I just want to bring up the point that what is left out of these discussions constantly is the role of masculinity. Almost all of these assaults and killings are by boys and young men, and it's part of normalized masculinity in our society for boys to be violent, for parents to teach their children, to their boys, to fight back. We see it in our movies. We see it in sports. We're told to man up and to, I won't use the terms, but they're derisive terms that question our masculinity if we don't respond to an assault or an attack or criticism with violence. And so it's a broader sociological question that needs to be addressed, and it never is.
Chris, thank you very much. And Andrew in Bloomfield, I'm going to give you the last word with just a few seconds left. Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to build on, what some of the previous callers, and from a public policy standpoint, whether really it is, a poor decision to be focusing so much on physical security in terms of funding with, trying to harden the school building to be impenetrable, when really, at least from my experience in high school, there's very little accessibility for counseling and mental health services for a lot of kids who really may have troubles.
And Andrew, I'm going to leave it there, and I think there's a lot more people want to join us, and you can continue this conversation at WNPR.org. Thanks to Commissioners William Shea and Donald DeFronzo. Thanks for all the phone calls, and thanks to you for listening to Where We Live.